Welcome to Berlin Inside Out, the podcast that takes an expert look at how Germany sees the world and the world sees Germany, with me, Benjamin Tallis.
And me, Aaron Gash-Burnett.
Hello and welcome back to Berlin Inside Out, the foreign affairs podcast in association with the German Council on Foreign Relations that takes an expert look at how Germany sees the world and the world sees Germany. I'm Aaron Gash-Burnett, a journalist and foreign policy analyst, and I'm here with my friend and co-host, Benjamin Tallis, senior research fellow here at the Council and head of its action group, Zeitenwende. Now, Ben, today we're really getting into an existential theme, the nuclear question. And it's a topic we've touched on before in Berlin Inside Out, mostly because despite Russia's war in Ukraine being a conventional war, the nuclear dimension is always there. Chancellor Olaf Scholz has used the German public's fear of nuclear war to present himself as a cautious decision maker who is trying to prevent this war from escalating into a nuclear conflict. This, he reasoned, was legitimate grounds for not sending Taurus cruise missiles. It was also part of why he was so hesitant to send Leopard tanks before the US agreed to send Abrams tanks. Keine Alleingänge, or no going it alone, really means not without the American nuclear guarantee. That's one part of the story, but is that all of it, Ben? How much is the nuclear dimension really at play here in some of these decisions by Scholz, do you think?
Well, I think it's certainly in play as a reason sometimes, but more often as an excuse not to act, not to step up and actually face down the Russian threat. And this is an excuse born of a willful ignorance of how deterrence actually works, and in fact, a willful forgetting of the role that Germany played so well as a frontline state during the Cold War, when both the German people and their leaders, like those of other NATO allies, understood both defense and deterrence rather better than they do now. And that's what we're here to try and address through the whole series, but also particularly on this episode, to understand how Germany can go about relocating its geostrategic compass, including by raising its deterrence and nuclear IQ. And by doing that, Germany can play a fuller role in the defense of security, prosperity, and freedom in Europe, can be a better NATO ally. And honestly, it needs to, because some of the discussions that we've been having in recent weeks at some of the leading security conferences around Europe with policymakers, as well as policy shapers and experts, shows that Germany's really losing credibility fast. The discussion, as well as the action on the ground, is moving on without Germany. The pace of geopolitical events is faster than that of the so-called new German speed. And so while Germany still deliberates and hesitates, others are actually stepping up and stepping forward. Now, that's an important thing for Germans to realize, because they need to have a clearer input on the direction in which that's going, because they have a stake in the outcome. Their security, prosperity, and freedom are at stake here as well. And so in order to actually play that shaping role, that crucial role that we know Germany could play, much as it did during the Cold War, we need to address this failing of understanding and failure of willpower from German politicians. And of course, we have to consider the flip side as well. If Germany doesn't get its strategic act together and doesn't start actually coming to a better posture that reflects the realities of deterrence rather than just simply the horror at the potential consequences of nuclear war, and so actually explores what needs to be done in order to make our deterrence credible, then it not only faces a loss of credibility. Germany is, of course, in range of Russian missiles and would present itself as a tempting target for coercion, but also potentially for actual attack. And that's something that Germans need to be very clear about, and which currently some of their politicians are not being sufficiently honest with them about. And so this seemingly risk-averse strategy that's often put forward is actually extremely risky for Germany. And again, we're here to address that today with the experts we're going to be talking through, who give a real guide as to what you need to know to understand nuclear deterrence and to understand deterrence more widely and how it fits into the security situation and the kind of geopolitics that we've been talking about on the first two seasons of Berlin Inside Out.
And we've got some great guests today to help us get into both Putin's nuclear blackmail and how successful it is in deterring a leader like Olaf Scholz. But before we go to them, a quick overview. The world has 9 nuclear nations possessing about 12,500 nuclear weapons between them. All 5 permanent UN Security Council members have them, plus Pakistan, India, Israel, and North Korea. Russia and the US have the lion's share of these at over 5,000 each. 5 countries, including Germany, host American nuclear weapons as part of NATO. With that background in, let's bring in our first guest today, Fabian Hoffmann. Fabian is a doctoral research fellow at the Oslo Nuclear Project hosted by the University of Oslo. Now, Fabian, let's talk first about a recent tweet by Chancellor Olaf Scholz reacting to Russia's announced nuclear step up, where Scholz said in English, "It is always important to make clear that nuclear weapons must not be used in this war." And this tweet left you a little lost for words at first. So, Fabian, welcome to the show. What do you make of that Scholz tweet now and the kind of message it sends about how Scholz understands nuclear issues?
Yeah, hi, great to be here. So basically, the issue with the tweet is that it acknowledges the nuclear threat made by Putin, right? It basically signals to the world that Germany, that Scholz, the government, is really concerned about what is going on in the nuclear domain and these nuclear threats made by Russia. But at the same time, it does not address the core issue, and that is that we are threatened by a nuclear power. The response is signaling risk aversion. It is signaling pain and tolerance. So basically, Scholz is giving Putin everything that he's asked for with the nuclear threat. And that's, of course, really bad, right? So I think either you simply ignore the message that comes from Moscow, you don't even react to it, or if you decide to react to it, then you have to provide a forceful response where you try to make clear to your opposite that you will not be threatened, you will not be coerced, but this weird middle way that Scholz has chosen, that's really disadvantageous to the government, to Germany, and to NATO.
Exactly. It has the effect of sowing more fear without giving the impression we know what to do about it. This is really, as you say, the worst of all possible worlds. And to me and many others, and you made your feelings about this clear too, Fabian, many times on Twitter and elsewhere, it really epitomizes the low level of nuclear understanding, deterrence discourse, and deterrence knowledge in the German public and political debate. So given that low level of knowledge and a low level of discourse, what would you do to improve it? What do Germans and their leaders need to know about nuclear deterrence and how it works?
Yeah, so I think one of the core issues that we have in Germany, and one thing that our decision makers do not fully understand when it comes to nuclear decision making, is the role of risk taking. Right now, NATO is in what we would call in the academic literature a risk taking competition with Russia. There is a nuclear threat, there is a nuclear risk over what is going on in Ukraine. And right now, we have to make sure that we can support Ukraine and we keep supporting Ukraine without this thing escalating to a nuclear level, right? And in order to do that, you have to make sure that there is a level of nuclear deterrence where Russia understands, right, that them resorting to nuclear use will not be beneficial, will not be advantageous to their objectives. And here's the fundamental paradox of the nuclear age, probably. In order to effectively deter nuclear use of the adversary, you have to make clear to the adversary in a credible way that if push comes to shove, you're willing to do what's necessary to defeat the adversary, even on the nuclear level. Right? So basically, I have to threaten nuclear use in order to deter nuclear use by the adversary. And that's something that was fundamentally understood during the Cold War, right? That doesn't mean that we're running around and constantly calling for nuclear weapons to be used on our adversaries, but we try to make clear to our opponents, or the United States in particular, to the Soviet Union, that if push comes to shove, the United States is absolutely willing to employ nuclear weapons over what's going on in Europe. And so basically what this means is you have to accept a certain level of risk. Without doing that, it will be really, really difficult for Germany, for NATO, for Ukraine to get out of this, right? Because if we don't do this, we make ourselves susceptible to nuclear coercion. And this is exactly what Putin wants.
Right. And the paradox you're getting at there is that by supposedly accepting no risk, you actually make yourself less safe.
Yeah, exactly. I would say that not accepting any risk is even the riskier, or is actually the riskier strategy, because you make yourself open to the type of nuclear coercion that Putin threatens us with.
This is a problem with the whole way this discourse is framed in the German debate in particular, because the threats are all coming publicly from one side. The saber rattling, the nuclear saber rattling is coming from the Kremlin and from Putin's outriders in the Russian media, Medvedev and others. But we have nuclear weapons too. And exactly what you mentioned before, call it mutually assured destruction, call it you nuke us, we'll nuke you back, in very, very simple, basic terms, there is a balance there. And that's not something that we see understood or discussed properly. Instead, we're seeing fear on one side only. Why do you think that is?
There's an asymmetry in terms of the risks that either side is willing to accept. And there's also an asymmetry in terms of the perceived pain intolerance or pain tolerance on both sides. Russia has made clear, including through its military strategies on the battlefield in Ukraine, that it is absolutely willing to accept huge numbers of casualties. At the same time, some of the strategies or simply the fact that it has been willing to go to this length and invade a country like Ukraine in the first place also tells us something about the risk willingness of Russia. And then basically, in order to counter that, we have to tell Russia that, yes, we are also able and willing to take risks. And then you're looking again at our decision makers in Berlin and other European capitals, and what we're signaling is the complete opposite.
So let's talk about that for a minute. A lot of Scholz's red lines, these kinds of self-imposed red lines, have a nuclear dimension. And this is quite clear. He presents himself as being this careful statesman of sorts that is doing everything he possibly can to shield the German public from risk, particularly nuclear risk. This is definitely something that plays into the chancellor's thinking around the decision not to send Taurus, for example, or even to wait until the U.S. agreed to send Abrams tanks in order to be able to send Leopards. A lot of this really did seem to have a nuclear dimension, and the whole phrase keine Alleingänge, and never alone, that was used around Leopards, really seemed to suggest that, not without the nuclear guarantee, and specifically the U.S. Nuclear guarantee. Will we do anything?
In the end, it is about escalation. So the chancellor is afraid that by delivering Taurus, for example, that this might trigger escalation with Russia and NATO, and then also Germany being drawn into the war. And that, of course, is so potentially catastrophic in the minds of Scholz and others, because escalation then also immediately has this nuclear dimension. That sure, the fighting might start on a conventional level. NATO and Russia might not immediately confront each other with nuclear weapons, but once the fighting has started, there is a chance that the war will escalate and nuclear weapons will eventually be employed.
But he's so transparent about this as well. He's so transparent about what will deter him.
One thing that I give to the opponents of Taurus deliveries, right, is that, you know, even though I believe that nuclear escalation or any type of escalation where NATO is directly drawn into the war over Taurus deliveries or the delivery of any other single weapon system, it's really, really low. It's minuscule, but it's not zero, right? There is a non-zero chance that sure that if we use or deliver a certain weapon system to Ukraine, that this might cross some perceived threshold, some red line inside the Kremlin. Although again, right, and I think this is really something we have to emphasize, the risks for that are extremely low. Not least because nuclear weapons used by Russia would also impose tremendous risks on the decision makers in the Kremlin. I mean, the political, economic, military risks that that go together with nuclear use, they're really, really high. Right? So overall, I believe that the chances of nuclear escalation or any type of escalation are really low. Yes, they're not zero, but this is again then where the role of risks comes in again. Because the probabilities are not zero, you have to be willing to accept the certain amount of risk that comes with decision making. That is natural and that is necessary. And that is unfortunately what Scholz is not willing to do.
No, indeed. And it also shows either an unwillingness or an inability to calculate competing risks against each other, while being unwilling to accept any risk seemingly there, which we've said it's already actually a more risky option. What that puts you at greater risk of is coercion of all sorts of different kinds. And those two things that you've mentioned there, Fabian, fear and signaling fear and signaling pain aversion, that you're not willing to take any pain at all, make you extremely susceptible to potential coercion. And this was the fear of NATO throughout the Cold War, of course, that actually the Russians would be able to win without firing a shot, because the threat of force would be enough to actually pick off the Europeans one by one, because they'd effectively go soft because they didn't want to bear any of this potential pain. So why haven't we learned those lessons from the Cold War?
That's a great question. I think we learned those lessons. I think they just largely got forgotten. Or we now have decision makers in place that either don't want to listen to history or just have never learned them. I mean, you are absolutely right. During the Cold War, the challenge that NATO faced was not to convince the Soviet Union that it had the means to completely annihilate the territory. The real challenge was convincing the Russians that the United States was willing to go to these great lengths to employ nuclear weapons over issues on the European continent. That was the core issue. And the United States went to enormous lengths to reassure its European allies that it would indeed intervene in any conflict with the Soviet Union, even if that meant that it had to accept enormous nuclear risks. Right? And this is, for example, why we had American brigades in West Berlin and all over Western Germany. I mean, in the end, you know, especially the one in West Berlin, that brigade wasn't there to hold off the Soviet Union. They were there to die. And they were to die because it means that the United States is immediately drawn into the conflict. And that tells the Soviet Union that also for them, the risks of nuclear escalation are eventually really, really high. So again, I think the decision makers during the Cold War, they either understood that intuitively or they had to learn that really, really fast. And then, you know, after the 1990s, we had this beautiful time of the peace dividend where we almost forgot about nuclear weapons. And now, painstakingly, I think we have to relearn those lessons. And unfortunately, we also just live in an era, I think, where a lot of decision makers just they fundamentally don't understand the condition of living with existential risk anymore, at least in Western Europe. Right? This is totally different for those living in Poland or the Baltics. They fully understand that the stakes are existential. But in France, UK, especially Germany, unlike during the Cold War, where the risks were truly existential, this is no longer the case, at least immediately for Germany. I think that's one of the big problems.
Right. And it also seems a bit uncivilized, I think, to some people today who either have the feeling that we've condemned war and all of this nasty business of thinking through killing each other to the past, and us now, our civilized folk who've moved on from that. They don't want to think about a brigade of soldiers being sent somewhere to die, or more specifically, to be willing to die in order that no one has to die. And that's the point of that isn't really thought through, because the first part of the calculation is so abhorrent to some contemporary sensibilities, the thinking about it stops there, that this must be a terrible idea. And that's, I think, where we get stuck, because we don't go further in that, and therefore the risk calculation and so on is not actually made properly.
The U.S. during the Cold War demonstrated that it was willing to use nuclear weapons due to issues that might happen on the European continent, that this was a level of risk that it was willing to accept. But then if we look back to Olaf Scholz's decisions, as we were talking a moment ago, he never seems to take any decisions unless he has American cover, because there is that nuclear guarantee that comes implicit with any contribution that comes from the United States. But are we missing, is he missing the fact, or perhaps not trusting, that the French and the UK, who are also fellow NATO members, also have their own nuclear deterrence and have acted quite a bit ahead of the Germans when it comes to delivering anything from Storm Shadow missiles, for example? Is it that Olaf Scholz just simply doesn't trust the fact that there is a European pillar to NATO, including on nuclear issues? Or is it also perhaps that we simply have not discussed the European dimension of extended deterrence nearly enough? Or is it both? What do you think?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question, to be honest, especially in regard to the French nuclear deterrent, right? It's interesting because if we think about existential threats that Germany could face in a war, right? The moment, let's say, Russia invades and they get increasingly close to Berlin and other German population centers, and threats become existential for Germany, I think you would have a really hard time making the argument that these same threats are not also existential on some level to France. Which means that right at that moment, French nuclear use might be warranted. So I think in that sense, there is a real deterrence purpose behind the French nuclear deterrent also for Germany. I mean, right, I as a German, and in that sense, I feel quite secured by the French nuclear arsenal. I think it plays a huge role in the European deterrence architecture, and then the same, of course, also counts for the United Kingdom. And then, right, why is there such a perceived asymmetry where Scholz apparently always looks to the United States? And not also to European allies or allies on the European continent with nuclear weapons. I think it would be difficult to fully reduce that to the nuclear arsenal, although I believe that in Scholz's mind, I think there's a good chance that the American nuclear arsenal is a lot more present than the French and the British nuclear arsenals. But I think it's also the overall conventional and economic might that stands behind the United States. And this is what Scholz is looking at. And this is what he wants for him to back him up in his decision making.
Other countries in Europe, as you mentioned, who have different risk calculations and who deal with fear differently, have also taken a different approach, as Aaron mentioned, to weapons deliveries to Ukraine, but also to thinking about their own deterrence. And one country that stood out in that regard is Poland, which is making noises that it wants to participate in NATO nuclear sharing. So Aaron mentioned before, there are five countries currently that host US nuclear bombs, B-61 gravity bombs. And Poland wants a piece of that action too. It has the F-35s coming in that could actually perform that role. Same thing as for Germany and for several of the other partners. Why is Poland seeking to do that? And would that actually be enough? Or should Poland be seeking its own nuclear deterrent, actually?
Yeah, I mean, Poland, I think, is doing it because they see how the European security architecture has changed in the last couple of years, and they perceive a very clear existential threat. And they believe that under certain circumstances, their conventional capabilities may not be enough to fully deter Russia, or at least they believe that their overall deterrent could be propped up by a nuclear arsenal in whatever form. And you're correct, the Poles have asked NATO and especially the United States to provide a forward deployed nuclear deterrent similar to the deterrence arrangement with Germany and Italy, for example. And so far, NATO has rejected that. So they are not yet willing to deploy forward deployed nuclear weapons to Poland. And that means that if Poland is serious about deploying a nuclear capability, the only option would be to deploy an independent nuclear deterrent. That, of course, comes with tremendous risks also for Polish decision makers, right? If Poland were to go down that route, I mean, I think at least in the short term, that would undermine crisis stability in the sense that it would, at least it would provide incentives for Russia to challenge Poland sooner than later before it deploys a nuclear arsenal. But then if you think maybe in the medium to long term, I think there are a couple of states, especially in Eastern Europe, especially the Baltics and Romania, for example, that might actually appreciate an independent nuclear deterrent in an Eastern European country. So I don't think that this is a decision that is taken lightly. No, I'm out of it. I don't think that this is a decision that is that is taken lightly by Polish decision makers at all. Obviously, it is very complex. I don't think that right now Poland is on the verge of taking that decision of building, manufacturing, developing an independent nuclear deterrent, but it's definitely also not something that we should completely ignore, at least when we're looking at what Polish decision makers are signaling to us right now in this regard.
Fabian, perhaps just for the benefit of our listeners, you could also talk us through a little bit what this phrase independent nuclear deterrent means, because technically France has an independent nuclear deterrent, whereas the UK's nuclear forces are not independent as such. So what are the differences there?
Some of that really depends a bit on how you define it. I would say by and large, the British also deploy an independent nuclear deterrent in the sense that the final decision-making over nuclear weapons use rests solely with British authorities. And that's, of course, also the case with France. Where the two arsenals maybe differ slightly is that the British nuclear arsenal is very dependent on technology transfers from the United States. So, for example, it's a ballistic missile submarine fleet, the technology for that. So for submarine launched ballistic missiles, essentially. A lot of technology comes from the United States, and actually the UK has faced tremendous difficulties in reshoring some of that competence to build and manufacture its own nuclear deterrent. For France, that's very different. They have maintained also a highly independent nuclear arsenal in that regard, so they are fully capable, as far as we know, of manufacturing their ballistic missiles, their warheads, the cruise missiles that they may use for these tasks and purposes.
Indeed, strategic economic sovereignty for their nuclear force, as if we combine several of Emmanuel Macron's various different concepts that have come out over the last few years.
Strategic nuclear autonomy.
Macron medley, indeed. Right, let me just talk to you quickly then, Fabian, about the weapons actually involved. Because now we've heard about the nuclear sharing, which involves the gravity bombs, and you've just mentioned the submarine-launched ballistic missiles. In serious terms, what value do those gravity bombs have? Where does the main nuclear deterrent value come from? What kind of weapons are we talking about when we talk nuclear? And also below the nuclear threshold, what are the main weapons that we need to know about when it comes to our deterrence?
Probably we can make a broad distinction between strategic nuclear weapons and non-strategic nuclear weapons. Basically, I mean, there are different terms for it, right? I don't like the term tactical nuclear weapon because I think it is a bit too deterministic in what it implies about usage and what it looks like. So basically, strategic nuclear weapons, those are the really large yield warheads that if push comes to shove, you would launch against the adversary's population centers. Or alternatively, if you believe, right, you can disarm the adversary outright prior to him launching his nuclear arsenal, you might also want to employ these weapon systems against the adversary's nuclear forces. So often you find these really large strategic nuclear warheads on ballistic missiles, also on long-range ballistic missiles or intercontinental-range ballistic missiles, right? The ones that you can shoot all around the world, right? Basically you can pretty much land anywhere and threaten any target. But you might also find them in the form of gravity bombs or also on cruise missiles. So it's really just about where you would want to deploy those warheads on what types of capabilities. And then you have other types of nuclear weapons. We refer to them sometimes as non-strategic nuclear weapons, sometimes also as tactical nuclear weapons. And usually the difference is that you want to use them for different tasks and purposes. So, for example, a non-strategic nuclear warhead might be beneficial to achieve battlefield effect, where I want to be somewhat discriminatory, right? So, for example, with a 1 megaton nuclear warhead, which if I'm not incorrect right now, is the equivalent of 1 million tons of TNT, it might be really difficult to achieve discriminatory effects on the battlefield. So I might want to choose a lower yield nuclear warhead somewhere around 10 to 20 kilotons, for example. I might also want to employ a non-strategic nuclear warhead purely for signaling purposes. And this is, for example, one of the scenarios that we might be a bit concerned about when it comes to Russia, that at one point they could launch a nuclear warhead or detonate a nuclear warhead over an unpopulated area or territory simply to signal to NATO and the world that certain thresholds have been crossed and that nuclear weapons use has become feasible. So I think by and large, this is the nuclear arsenal that we're dealing with on the side of NATO, but then also on Russia's side. There are other capabilities, right? Also what we might refer to as strategic level capabilities. And I think a really big role here play long-range strike weapons. So for example, I think when it comes to Russian nuclear use, one way to deter that is not necessarily that we as NATO say that, right? If you nuke us or if you nuke Ukraine, we're going to nuke you back. I mean, one basic issue with that is that it might not be necessarily very credible. Russia might not believe us. So another option that we might have is simply to threaten retaliation with large-scale conventional missile attacks. And, you know, this is an area where NATO has tremendous capability, tremendous strength. And I think that is a very credible threat towards Russia and one that they take very, very seriously. So let's say if they attack a target in Ukraine with nuclear weapons, that we launch, you know, hundreds of cruise missiles, conventionally armed cruise missiles against them.
Now, Fabian, you mentioned that NATO has huge capability in that, but the US has huge capability in that, right? And so this is also where we get into a bit of a tricky situation if the US guarantee to Europe is not there.
Absolutely. I would say a lot of these contingency plans, what are we going to do if Russia goes nuclear? They rely on both the US nuclear arsenal, but especially the US conventional arsenal. So if we were to lack that arsenal in our response planning, I mean, that would be a tremendous hit to NATO's overall capability. And that for sure is concerning.
So Fabian, every public has a fear of nuclear war, which is understandable. But nuclear fear seems especially acute in Germany. And we have seen Olaf Scholz play to that fear as justification for not taking key decisions to support Ukraine, as we've discussed before. Is that perhaps because of something that you were saying before, a difference in what Germans consider to be existential? So for example, for the Baltics and the Poles, a Russian invasion by conventional means, not even going up to the nuclear level, is already existential. But for Germans, they can't really necessarily imagine a conventional invasion by Russia. There's several other countries in the way first. Is that one of the reasons why the nuclear question hangs over the German public so much, do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. I would definitely say so. I mean, first of all, right, nuclear weapons, they're absolutely terrifying capabilities. And we should fault absolutely no one for being afraid of the prospect of nuclear war. Right? I think it would be strange if we were not at least deeply concerned about it. But then again, right, I think this demands, especially because that's the case, right? Especially because we might get clouded by a fear in this regard. It demands a rational response from our decision makers that might be able to look beyond the immediate consequences of nuclear use and might be able to look at the broader elements of nuclear strategy. And I think that's what we're lacking in Europe in general, and then especially in Germany.
Do you think that Germans underprice that risk of non-nuclear strategic threat to their country from the Russian long-range missile strike complex?
Yeah, probably. I mean, I think a lot of Germans don't fully understand that, you know, with nuclear weapons or not, we are already in range of Russian missile capabilities. And there is a very clear threat that, you know, if Russia at one point decides that they want to escalate the war or that they have to escalate the war for whatever reason, and they have the capability to do so, if we don't convince them that it would not be in their favor, Germany is fully in range of what Russia refers to as its non-nuclear strategic arsenal, so including short-range conventionally armed ballistic missiles and then also cruise missile capabilities. And Russian doctrine very clearly outlines that in specific phases of a conflict, these weapon systems would be used against the critical civilian infrastructure of the adversary. And I think this is something that in Germany we have to recognize. Again, right? Don't let this cloud your judgment by fear, but be rational about it, but also be aware that this is, you know, something that, that is a concrete threat. But then again, also understand that there are things that we can do about it. We can build up denial capabilities like missile defense, like a counter-strike capability. And, you know, most importantly, we have to make sure that right now we convince Russia that any such escalation would not be in its own interest. And we do that by signaling strength to Russia, not weakness.
Well, exactly so. To signal that, to have the capabilities, but also the attitude that makes Putin and his crew think, not today. So Fabian Hoffman, thank you so much for joining us today. That's been great to talk to you about these issues. You can find Fabian, of course, on Twitter, and you can find some of his publications in our show notes. Fabian Hoffman, from Berlin to Oslo, have a wonderful evening.
Thanks very much to Fabian Hoffman for taking us through how Russia's nuclear blackmail is shaping German foreign policy right now and the various dimensions of that. Let's go on to our next guest to take us through how this fits into a wider global context, among other topics we'll be talking about today. First up, we have my fellow Canadian, Carrie Buck. Her long career in diplomatic service includes a post as Canada's ambassador and permanent representative to NATO, and she is now a senior fellow at Ottawa's Graduate School of Public and International Affairs. With her today, we have William L. Burke, former director of Strategy, Technology, and Arms Control at the International Institute of Strategic Studies, with whom he is still associated, and a great expert on all things nuclear. Welcome to the show. Let's start with you, William, quickly. You have argued before that you don't think Putin is likely to use nuclear weapons in this conflict. Why do you think that is?
To put simply, when you think about whether or not Russia is going to use nuclear weapons, you have to think, what's the theory behind it? What are they trying to get out of that nuclear use? I think probably before the conflict, Vladimir Putin himself may have had some different ideas about how useful nuclear blackmail and nuclear coercion would be in the conflict. And throughout the conflict, you've heard him use ratchet up and ratchet down nuclear threats in order to try to influence NATO policy. But in terms of Russian doctrine itself, from my understanding, from my studies, I would say that Russia uses nuclear weapons in order to try to control escalation within the crisis. So, for instance, in Ukraine, Russia's number one priority for its nuclear deterrent is to prevent direct intervention from the United States or from U.S. allies. They don't want to fight us because they would lose, and they would lose badly. So they want to use nuclear deterrence to keep us from engaging directly in combat operations against Russian forces. In general, this is very consistent with Russian doctrine. It's all about how to control escalation, to prevent a local war from becoming a regional war, unless Russia wants it to, or to prevent a regional war from becoming a U.S.-Russia war. So they'll use nuclear deployments, they'll use nuclear threats, they'll use nuclear exercises in order to try to influence, shape Western reactions and Western policies, Western decisions. If they thought there was a utility of using these on the battlefield, then they certainly would. But you look at the battlefield, and where exactly would they use a nuclear strike? If you're talking about a battlefield nuclear weapon, what we used to call tactical nuclear weapons, you're talking about weapons with an atomic yield of several hundred tons up to several thousands, maybe tens of thousands of tons. These are really good for destroying massed forces in very concentrated areas. And that's not really how Ukraine has been operating throughout the conflict. They've been operating with hit-and-run tactics, getting very close to the Russian forces, but not really mass tank battles in the way that you would imagine large-scale nuclear strikes would work. In addition, you would use nuclear strikes, and Russia conceives of nuclear strikes, as demoralizing the foe. And you've seen this mirrored in how they use conventional forces. They want to kill lots of civilians in order to try to knock Ukraine out of the war. Would going to the nuclear level help them in that regard? I would argue that if they were to use nuclear weapons to try to demoralize Ukraine, it would fail utterly. It would actually galvanize Ukraine massively. And you've got that other element. if they were to go to the nuclear level, they would risk the direct involvement of the United States. And this is where I think U.S. private signaling to Russia has been very effective. Now, we don't have direct evidence of this, but we have lots and lots of circumstantial evidence that from the earliest stages of the conflict, the U.S. has communicated directly to Russia at the level of the National Security Advisor and other levels that if they were to use nuclear weapons, that would be the risk that the U.S. would come in. In fact, the U.S. would unleash devastating conventional strikes on Russian forces in order to deny them a victory on the battlefield. And I think Putin takes that very seriously. And there's one other thing to talk about in terms of Russia and the use of nuclear weapons in Ukraine, and that's how the rest of the world would react. And I'm not talking about in terms of moral reaction, because Putin certainly doesn't care at all how people react morally to what he does. Obviously, he's willing to kill civilians in huge numbers to allow his forces to commit horrible atrocities. What he does care about is whether China and India and other countries will continue to trade with him and allow him to avoid the pressure of sanctions. And in that regard, I think President Xi Jinping and Modi in India have both made it absolutely clear that they do not want to see nuclear weapons involved in this conflict. And Xi has said so directly several times, including very recently. So I think there is that worry in the back of Putin's head that, number one, the U.S. would get involved, and number two, if he loses trade from China and India and other countries in the non-aligned movement in the Third World and the Global South that he has been relying upon so far in order to relieve the pressure from sanctions, that truly could create the conditions for not only a Russian defeat in the battlefield, but a broader blow to the Russian economy that might see him losing power.
I agree with William. When you saw a heightening of Putin's nuclear rhetoric around October 2022, at the same time you saw a flurry of activity with Western diplomats, but primarily Western diplomats from nuclear powers, heading off to Beijing and heading off to India as well. And that was no happenstance or coincidence. Pressure was definitely being applied on those states, though they would then apply collateral pressure on Russia. And I also agree with William that it's clear, not clear that tactical nuclear weapons would give Russia a battlefield advantage. You know, conventional weapons are more precise. They can achieve most of the same military effects on a battlefield. They don't carry the same geopolitical risks. But the threat of use, which we've seen continuously since well before the full-on invasion 2 years ago, the threat of use, particularly against civilian or political targets, does give Putin a psychological advantage, aimed at either convincing Ukraine to stand down or the West to limit its support. But here's where I differ. The problem is that's not working, right? And deterrence rests on rational calculation. Before the war, most Western analysts, myself included, thought Putin wouldn't launch the largest ground war in Europe since World War II because it wasn't in Russia's interest. And yet, every time we think, no, he wouldn't, would he? Well, yes, he would. And I think that the existential threat that appears to be driving Putin right now is not to the Russian state, but to his own hold on power. So it depends how the war progresses. The odds are slim of Putin remaining in place in the event of a total collapse of Russian conventional forces in Ukraine, or even worse for Putin if Ukraine were to take back Crimea. Putin's become over the years a personalist dictator, and they will almost always choose rash military moves over prudence if there's a perceived threat to their own regime, right? So, while I agree with William that the chances of him actually using nuclear weapons in the conflict are slim, it would be very unwise, I think, for the West to discount that possibility. So it's a very fine line between not self-deterring, but on the other hand, not risking World War III.
Right. Let me follow up on that, William, and come to you with that. Because what you mentioned before about the US private signaling being extremely effective, plus the other signaling that's been done by other players in the game, by India, by China, etc., that would seem to suggest that the German fear that is so manifest of nuclear use is unjustified. But listening to what Kerry just said, there's another element to it as well. How would you weigh those things?
Directly apropos to what Kerry was saying, there is an actual debate that is occurring in Russia, in public, in Russian only, between a fellow by the name of Sergei Karaganov, a former noted arms controller named Dmitry Trenin, and Vladimir Putin himself, which actually surfaced at the Valdai Club in October. Where basically Karaganov has been writing papers since June of last year saying that nuclear deterrence, quote unquote, is not working with the West, and therefore we need to reassert deterrence potentially by striking at a NATO ally that is supporting Ukraine in order to reestablish deterrence. Now, of course, this is a different use of the word deterrence than we use in the West. This is nuclear coercion, pure and simple. And yes, being a nuclear power does not mean you get everything that you want. And watching Russians have this argument in real time about why don't we get everything that we want? That's really weird. We have nuclear weapons and they know that we might use them. So why don't they just give us what we want? I think this speaks to 30 years of German policy and of Western policy in general, of either not caring about Russia or basically shrugging and saying, oh, it's fine. Oh, you can't remove your forces from Moldova because they're old ladies throwing themselves in front of ammunition trains and you couldn't possibly control that. Sure, then just keep your forces in Moldova forever. Who cares? That kind of attitude. You invaded Georgia? Well, let's have a reset. Let's see if that works. You know what I mean? I think we've kept going back and back and back and rewarding Russian bad behavior. And so they really, I think we've helped teach them that in the face of threats, in the face of hard military action, the West will back down. And I think February 2022 came as a huge shock to the Russian system, the way that the West has reacted, the way that the West has held together. We might complain about how we haven't done enough, but I think it has deeply shocked the Russian system and a lot of assumptions they have about Western cohesion. So I would say that our past behavior in terms of backing down or not taking Russia seriously, not standing up to their threats, not standing up to their actions, has taught Russia that they can get away with things. And so now they're having this argument about, okay, how do we reinstill that fear in the West so that they just back down? It reminds me a lot of President Richard Nixon. In 1970, privately, he had these conversations with his security team, including Kissinger, that he needed to reinstill fear in the Soviets and the North Vietnamese. And they called this madman theory, where he would just say nutty things. Strategic Air Command actually had the largest scramble of nuclear forces they ever had in the Cold War, was just to try to intimidate the Soviets and North Vietnamese to pressure North Vietnam into negotiations. And it didn't work. So I'm a little surprised Putin isn't a little bit more aware that nuclear weapon armed states don't get what they want, that the asymmetry of interests and the asymmetry of risks of introducing nuclear weapons is such that it's just not credible. And so that's why Karaganov is suggesting, why don't we let one off and just see what happens? It's a crazy idea for all the reasons that we just discussed. But as Kerry pointed out, this is an idea that they are exploring with. They're toying with this right now. This latest tactical nuclear weapons exercise, non-strategic nuclear weapons exercise that Russia is about to carry out. We've seen Belarusian nuclear capable forces moving in this exercise. This is all designed to try to reinstill that fear. And so how much will they miscalculate here? Will they go too far? Will they think that the use of a nuclear weapon, even a demonstration use in order to reinstill fear in the West is necessary to achieve their strategic policy outcomes? That's a big question. And so I think Kerry is right. You can't completely discount that they'll go too far because they have gone too far before.
Very interesting point. And yes, the madman point was exactly where I was going to go actually with this, because indeed, Kerry, you mentioned this, the whole deterrence scenario depends on rational calculation, but on both sides. And Russia was expecting us to follow the path that William had outlined. And then suddenly we became unpredictable, actually, in this circumstance. Our actions in relation to Ukraine became unpredictable to the Russian calculus, which has thrown them back on their heels a little bit. But I wanted to ask you both, because you both worked at NATO for a long time in different capacities. You mentioned in the very beginning, William, that the use of Russian or the Russian use of nuclear language, nuclear signaling, etc., is part of escalation management and part of managing the conflict, part of controlling the conflict in a way. How are we countering that? And how actually, because there's more than one player involved here, what are the tools at our disposal to actually have our influence and our say on that?
I think we've got two conundrums in the West. I think that Russia is more ably using the information space on nuclear threats than we are. And we need to think through strategically how we can send tougher messages, I think, more credible, tougher messages. But the conundrum is that managing it in many allied states like Canada and Germany with our own populations is going to be extremely difficult. And I would argue more difficult than it was in the Cold War, where the possibility of nuclear attack was more present in the minds of our citizenry than it is now. The second conundrum for the West, and I'm not answering your question, unfortunately, is the fraying of the nuclear taboo and language around nuclear taboo. So there's been an evolution over the last few years that's quite alarming. And it wasn't just Vladimir Putin when he, you know, threatened the world with consequences such as you've never seen in your entire history. He wasn't the first one to have loose talk around nuclear. I mean, President Putin was mirroring language used by President Trump in 2017 when he threatened North Korea with fire and fury like the world has never seen. And, you know, so we've had a gradual fraying of that nuclear taboo that has been in place, I would argue, since just after the Cuban Missile Crisis, when leaders on both sides started to understand that, you know, nuclear war can't be won, should never be fought, and maybe we need to be a little more careful. So, you know, if we do escalate our language on countermeasures in response to Russian nuclear use, what we're doing is more damage to that nuclear taboo. So in a conundrum on both of those fronts, I don't know the way forward. I mean, my gut is that we need stronger nuclear messaging, but we have to understand the impact on our own citizenry and on the nuclear taboo. It's a dangerous, dangerous space we're in.
Which raises another one of these interesting paradoxes that are often struggled to be dealt with in the public and political realm. As you rightly said, we have to, on the one hand, signal that we are credibly willing to use nuclear weapons in order to have effective deterrence. We have to say that there. But then there's this nuclear taboo, because we all know how absolutely awful this would be. And the role of the population in that, as you mentioned, during the Cold War, was also extremely uncertain. And this was the worries about actually being able to signal properly, as well as to deploy weapons in Europe during the Euro missiles crisis. The public opinion question on that was absolutely crucial.
I do think also, Ben, that does speak to the need for leadership and strategic communication, which, for example, Olaf Scholz in particular has not demonstrated. I mean, we've just spoken with Fabian Hoffman about how every time the nuclear issue comes up, it becomes very, very, very clear where Olaf Scholz's red lines are, including in terms of conventional support for Ukraine. You know, the message really is all Vladimir Putin has to do is wave his nukes around and Olaf Scholz will back down. That has happened again and again and again. So let me ask, you know, first of all, what is necessary in terms of having better strategic communication in the West about what this all means? How can we send the message that you can't just wave your nukes around and not expect a response from us?
Well, I don't think it's working. And even with Germany, I think you guys maintained your policy on nuclear sharing. You know, I would argue that grosso modo across the alliance, that nuclear saber rattling is not working. The thing I worry about is the fraying of Western resolve in its support for Ukraine due to a number of factors. A small bit would be the nuclear saber rattling, maybe, but it's just hard to maintain that unity of purpose. And my fear is that Putin will seek to exploit that fraying of Western resolve and Western unity around support for Ukraine in a way that goes well beyond the nuclear question, but I think would be disastrous for NATO, disastrous for the West, the non-geographic West.
William, when Aaron mentioned that point about Olaf Scholz's strategic communication not being all that it could be, I did see you nodding and smiling in a knowing fashion, having followed the German scene closely now for a few years. How would you go about managing Germany's strategic communication if that were up to you? If you were the Chancellor's senior advisor and had his ear, what would you be saying and signaling?
I mean, first, you'd have to go back to the beginning. And the thing that has stunned me about living in Germany is they seem to have absolutely no memory of West Germany's role in the Cold War as being a major military power, especially post-1955. And literally making the unification of Germany the world's problem, that this was going to be, you know, something, if it didn't happen on the terms that West Germany liked, that the world might end. And that was a difficult time, but that was okay. And we came out with an incredibly positive outcome, not only for Germany, but for all of Eastern Europe and all of the territories that the Soviet Union was occupying. So I take what Kerry says very, very seriously. We need to be careful in terms of nuclear rhetoric, but at the same time, we need to be comfortable with talking about what we would actually do with our policies, with our ideas. When I showed up at NATO in 2012, the idea was we were going to get rid of everything unilaterally and everything was going to be fine and peace was going to break out and NATO was going to wrap up. And obviously, that was already misreading the tea leaves from 2008, from the Georgian invasion and 2003, 2004. So there was a fundamental misunderstanding, and Germany just couldn't wait to get back to sleep. And then 2014 happened. And again, Germany just couldn't wait to go back to sleep. It's really been remarkable that 2022 had to occur before Germany would wake up. And as we all know, the German intelligence chief of intelligence was in Kiev when the invasion occurred, had no idea it was going to happen, had to run for it. Germany's almost willful blind spot has been an issue for a long time. And I still feel fear, even with Zeitenwende, that Germany might go back to sleep. So Germany has to get better at, number one, talking about the very important role it played in the Cold War, not just at resolving it, but in actually being the center of that conflict. And they have to get better at talking about what NATO would do in terms of deterrence now. I mean, we have these very vague terms we talk about. Introduction of nuclear weapons would fundamentally alter the nature of the conflict, blah, 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 blah. What does nuclear sharing mean? What does nuclear burden sharing mean? What would conflict look like? If Russia were to use nuclear weapons first, wouldn't we want to restore deterrence and not go to a full exchange? And what does that mean? What does that look like? During the Cold War, you'd be amazed at how many more people in the general public were much more versed with very complex warfighting topics and really understanding what conflict meant. I found a wonderful book in the NATO library written by a women's council out in Bristol, detailing the blow-by-blow negotiations that were happening in the 18-nation disarmament committee and what that would mean for the UK's role in nuclear sharing. And you read this and you forget, these were conversations that people were having around the kitchen table all the time. So if I were a German leader, what I would do is I would try to get people used to not loose talk, as Kerry pointed out. We want to maintain the nuclear taboo, but at least to understand the basic topics, to be comfortable with those basic topics. It is remarkable how much Finland and Sweden, for instance, have leapt ahead of Germany in terms of talking about deterrence, in terms of talking about integrating nuclear deterrence into their own planning, willing to say, we're joining NATO, but with no limitations, not like the Danes and the Norwegians in terms of how we'll do nuclear sharing. We have no limits. We'll figure it out as we go along. Truly extraordinary. Can you imagine if Olaf Scholz were saying things like, you know, in the future, what nuclear sharing will look like for Germany, I can't really say, but it's got to maintain peace and security, and it's got to make the Baltics feel reassured. And let's talk about what the different options are, and let's have a real debate about that. That would be extraordinary. But that's not what's happening in Germany. And so that's what I think leadership needs to do. Again, not to normalize the idea of nuclear strikes, you know, for Christmas, but let's actually talk about what this really means and what essential role that Germany's role in as a dual capable aircraft nation plays in keeping the alliance secure and how that role should evolve in the future. And I think if you're having those kinds of discussions and debates, then when Russia makes a nuclear threat, it is immediately contextualized by the public. They can understand where it's coming from. They can understand where Germany's deterrence stands in it. But if you keep nuclear as a topic, as a taboo, and you're only willing to talk about disarmament, then anytime Russia makes a direct nuclear threat, it instills a degree of panic that's, I think, truly unnecessary. And so treating the German public like grown-ups, having real conversations about this, we've seen policy on Russia shift. I think policy on nuclear deterrence also needs to shift within Germany. And that's going to require concerted leadership, a bit of fearlessness, some learning, some humility, all these things mixed together, which are, as we know, things that politicians don't do very well.
Right. I mean, this points to a number of issues. So the fabulous example you just gave us of the Bristol Women's Group actually debating this, going through the analysis of this, was because presumably they understood the stakes that were involved. They understood the very real meaning for this in their lives, which is something that politicians have tried to insulate our publics from for far too long. And so the reaction to this kind of talk stops at total panic or total horror rather than then actually going through analysis. And that's unfortunately the level of political discourse that we see.
If you draw a heat map of how NATO allies' defense spending has increased since the since 2014, but more importantly, since the full-scale attempted invasion in 2022, it's kind of a no-brainer, but those states closer to the Russian threat have increased their defense spending exponentially, and those of us farther out have been a lot more reticent. And the most reticent of all has been Canada, to be frank. And similar to the German population, we've forgotten what our stance was. We had the second or the third largest navy coming out of World War II, Canada did. At the time, 47% of the federal budget was spent on defense. Now we're down to maybe our plans are maybe to 1.74% of our GDP, and with no plan to get to 2%. So we've got a population here that I would argue is sleepwalking through today's heightened threat environment. we still assume that our geography protects us, except with today's threats, geography collapses, not just nuclear. That's kind of always been the case with nuclear, except in the early years of the Cold War, where you could see the planes that are going to drop the missiles coming over our Arctic. But a whole range of threat vectors now, as I said, collapse geography. And my argument back in Canada has been we need to have that kind of national awakening of the security threats and increased security literacy across our citizenry, including on nuclear, revitalize a lot of the expertise too. There's certain niche things that Canada was good at, verification, for instance, that kind of thing. But not just on nuclear, across the board of security threats. We're still sleepwalking over here in the north of North America.
But you've mentioned something earlier on in the show, Carrie, really going into US and German thinking on this, which is this worry about low probability events, but ones that would have very high impacts were that to happen. So, for example, loose nukes if Russia were to destabilize.
The U.S. has to worry about those things. And in a way, thank God they are. They're still the backbone of NATO and the backbone of European defense. And they still occupy that kind of leadership role. But the problem for the rest of us is the unpredictability of U.S. leadership and where U.S. administration's policy might go. I think that one of the reasons that, well, there are a number of reasons why Putin announced the last few days that they were going to exercise tactical nuclear weapons, but also, you know, parading their strategic, the Tsar's intercontinental ballistic missile through the streets of Moscow during the Victory Day parade, more nuclear threats in his Victory Day parade speech, etc. Why is he doing all of that now? A big part of it was that unpredictability inside the U.S. about support for Ukraine. And then when the decision was made to continue U.S. support for Ukraine, when Macron said that he wouldn't rule out putting French troops inside Ukraine, when the U.K. Gave permission to Ukraine to use U.K.-donated weapons inside Russia, all of those things were the prompt, right? But the backbone of our kind of consistency of our approach to Russia is still the U.S., I would argue. And I'm very, very worried about what next on U.S. administration policy, not just Trump and his threats to severely damage NATO, but also where the Republican Party is sitting in terms of its Russia policy. It's gone in a very weird direction. So I don't know, again, I don't know what the answer to this is, but for the rest of us, almost Trump-proofing our policy is really, really important. There are different ways of doing it, but Trump-proofing the policy is almost something that people need to be, states, allies need to be quietly thinking of, not talking about, but quietly preparing for.
Well, yes, indeed. And unfortunately, what we understand that's happening in Berlin is still very much a wait-and-see approach, by which time we see it will be too late to do enough about it, we'd argue. But that's been a consistent theme in European preparedness more widely in the last few years, it must be said. The best time to start was yesterday. The second best is today, so rather than waiting for tomorrow. Now, William, let me come to you on this a second, because Kerry rightly mentioned the US is still the backbone of European deterrence, both nuclear and conventional. But we're seeing some worrying trends in that regard, too. After the moment after the Korean War, where the US increased its forces, doubled its global force numbers from 1.5 million troops to 3 million troops between 1949 and 1952, the level of forces didn't drop below 2 million for the rest of the Cold War. We saw defense spending up 4% and higher. Now we see a US military with 1.3 million people. And we also see defense spending of 3.2%, which given inflation in costs of procurement, a lot of people estimate to be a little under 3%, in fact. These are surely the trends we need to be thinking about as well in terms of Trump-proofing. Is the US actual global power projection capability what it needs to be for itself and for its allies?
To be frank, I would say yes. I think there is a tendency to over-rely on the US for everything. And when you go back to the Cold War and you think about West Germany having, I forget how many, five, six armored divisions. The British army on the Rhine was massive. I think other allies need to step up. And let me put that in two ways. Number one, obviously, a lot of allies got rid of their concept of sort of a territorial armed force. You know, you think about Sweden, got rid of all of their land forces and instead only had, out-of-area operations, niche operators. If you look at countries like Spain and Portugal and Netherlands, a lot of these countries just cut and cut and cut and cut and cut. So they need to come back to some kind of defensive baseline where they can not only field troops to defend their own territory, which they can't, but also in theater power projection capability. So the ability to flow forces all the way through to Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia. Okay, so that needs to happen. Number two, I am not worried about US Army Europe. I think even under a Trump administration, he's going to keep forces in Poland. They'll call it Fort Trump, whatever. I think there are still those bonds to European defense that exist. I don't think it'll center around Germany anymore, which is sad. But there is something we can do about that, and I'll talk about that again in a second. But you know what I mean? The Pacific fight is not an army fight. The Pacific fight for the United States is a Navy and Air Force fight. So actually having heavy forces deployed in Europe, whenever anyone says, no, we need to keep flexible, that's nonsense. We don't need them. We're not gonna use, you know, the big army to back Taiwan or to fight in the South China Sea. It ain't gonna happen. So actually what the allies need to do then is to fill in all those capabilities where the U.S. does have to decide whether it's Pacific or Atlantic. So, for instance, airlift, sea lift, ammunition, all those things, allies can just make for themselves. There's no reason why allies have to rely on the U.S. for everything. They can actually help the United States future-proof the alliance by not forcing the U.S. to choose which theater to fight in, but rather to have those assets in theater. So when the U.S. says, oh no, we have to move stuff to Asia, the U.S., the allies say, sure, go right ahead. We're good. No, all that stuff we know, ISR, air refueling, all that stuff, we got it. Go to Asia. Good, 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 good. You know what I mean? A lot of Europeans are thinking, well, we need to send a boat to the Pacific once every 3 years because that'll help with no, it won't. It won't help at all. No. You know what? Defend your own territory. Defend Europe. That'll help.
But surely Shanghai doesn't have room for so many port calls, William.
The Netherlands, I swear to God, got up at Shangri-La Dialogue and said, we're going to send one ship to the Asian theater once every 2 years. And I just thought, wow, China's just, oh my God, yeah. They're going to surrender right now.
But Kerry, this has been a consistent theme of NATO's entire existence, trying to get the Europeans to do what they need to do. Think of Eisenhower banging his fist on the table in 1951, saying you have the capability, if you don't, you need to generate them. And trying to get Europeans to actually pony up for this. You mentioned Canada's difficulties in that before. Surely, I mean, the case William just outlined makes a lot of sense to a lot of people. I think even Elbridge Colby might come on board with some of what was said there. But what is the stumbling block here? You worked in the political side of NATO. You saw this up close. What do we need to do to actually get that message over?
Well, I think that Europe actually has woken up. If you look at the incredible spike in their defense spending, again, it's mostly those states that are closer to the threat. I think Europe has woken up. But, you know, it's going to take a long time to rebuild those capabilities that were dismantled over the course of a couple of decades, point one. But they get it. So your example, William, about, you know, land in Europe and air and maritime in Indo-Pacific is spot on. I remember when we were setting up the first enhanced forward presence in the Baltics, and one of the big concerns at the time from the US was they didn't want to be on the hook for all the enablers. So they wouldn't announce their role as framework nation, the Pentagon wouldn't anyway, until all the others had been locked in place, which made a lot of sense. So I think the theory is there. The second thing, what is Europe meant to do? So Canada has a bit of a challenge here. Because if Europe is building enough to secure its own defense, that is absolutely great, and that's in our interest. But the other challenge is decision-making capacity. And if Europe starts to move towards a separate decision-making capacity on European defense, then we get rid of that Euro-Atlantic space and the transatlantic unity across North America and Europe. And that, from a Canadian perspective, would leave us in a very weakened position. Either we are, you know, ineffective island Canada, fortress Europe, or we're sitting there as a vassal state of the US. And, you know, so for me, I think that NATO as the decision-making body is the way to go because it's in Canada's self-interest. I also think it's better for Euro-Atlantic peace and security with not a separate autonomous European decision-making capacity inside NATO or outside NATO, even worse, but with the European kit, the European capacities, capabilities built up. I actually think when NATO responded to the full-scale invasion of Ukraine, that's how it played out. And I actually think it was more useful in determining the division of labor between EU and NATO and the role of European allies inside NATO. So I think Europe's woken up to the need, but it's just going to take a hell of a long time to rebuild that capacity. I mean, the defense industrial base isn't there at all. Ukraine's burning through our ammunition quicker than any of us can produce and hand it over. So we really do have to speed it up.
We do, and not least in Germany, William. How can Germany get itself back, if it indeed wants to the center of those defense arrangements in Europe, as you mentioned before? And is that what we should actually be aiming for?
Honestly, I think the trajectory that Germany is on right now in terms of sort of squandering the Zeitenwende, Germany has done what it tends to do from time to time. It raises expectations massively. It then totally fails to fulfill those obligations. People from the outside pressure Germany into doing the right thing. They eventually do some sort of right thing, having lost all of the potential, you know, moral gains from making the announcement in the first place. But let's be clear, if Germany can't deliver on Zeitenwende, if Germany cannot deliver on transforming its defense and deterrence relationship with the Europeans, especially the Eastern Europeans, so that Germany is seen as maybe not the muscle, but the skeleton that is helping the United States and other allies, the connectivity, but also some actual real military force to defend Lithuania and to roll in there with a heavy division, with the sea lift capacity to go from Rostock to Klaipeda. If they can't deliver on their deterrence capabilities to defend Germany, number one, and number two, to project force within Europe to defend allies, then they're going to lose even more in the eyes of the allies. They will become even less the center of gravity of NATO. Right now, that center of gravity has shifted decisively towards the east, towards Poland and Finland. Poland, impatient with the pace of a lot of the military development projects started by the EU, have instead turned to the South Koreans. Finland, completely autonomous, 280,000 troops in crisis, 900,000 total in all-out war. The center of gravity is shifting. In the Cold War, it was West Germany that was really the center of gravity. So if Germany wants to be the center of the political and military debates, if they really want to be the powerhouse, then they have to put up, and not only put up, but be seen to put up credibly, so that the Eastern allies are going, yeah, you've made some mistakes over the past couple of years, but we like this. This is good. We can rely on you. You're a reliable partner for us in the deterrence and defense of the Euro-Atlantic area, in fulfilling SACEUR's AORR-wide plans, in fulfilling the regional defense plans, et cetera, et cetera. So if Germany wants to go back to sleep, well, all right, you know, that's the usual. They can do that. The usual since the end of the Cold War anyway. They can do that. But if they want to be the center both politically and militarily, the opportunity is open. Scholz, with the Zeitenwende speech, has opened the door. Now it's a question of delivering, and delivering in a way that makes countries like Poland and Lithuania and Latvia and Estonia say Germany is a reliable security partner. And if Finland, and they're looking at Germany going like, well, what's wrong with you guys? This is not hard.
So imagine a NATO if France becomes the center of political gravity. And imagine where that would drive NATO unity when you have a greater gap between French kind of policy, although Macron shifted it, French policy on the threat and what to do about it. I could see a NATO that's much less consensus-driven, much harder to achieve consensus if France becomes the political center of gravity. Germany makes me feel more comfortable.
That's something we're not used to hearing.
Yeah, moments of Berlin Side Out there, indeed. Yeah. Be careful. Never leave the hand of German nurse for fear of finding something worse.
It's odd. Like, I'm saying that my own personal capacity. And when France was threatening to withdraw from the alliance, and, you know, when NATO moved from Paris, I know that Canada went out to try and play a brokering role to. So what I just said would never be Canadian government policy ever.
No, very, very clear on that. You're speaking in your own capacity there, Kerry. Thank you for clarifying that.
Absolutely.
Aaron.
Yeah. Let's talk, though, quickly about the value of nuclear sharing in all of this, because, I mean, German policy, as you were pointing out, William, there's a lot of wanting for leadership, and then it ends up going to just see what the U.S. is going to do before it does anything, including on conventional deliveries, as we've discussed, because the nuclear dimension just sits there. What is the value of nuclear sharing and kind of reinforcing our alliance in at a time like this, keeping in mind, of course, that Germany is one of the countries that does host American nukes?
Put your feet up a little bit because, all right, no, threatening with history. If you saw Oppenheimer, actually, one of the things that got Oppenheimer fired, General Leslie Groves was deeply upset that Oppenheimer, as part of this thing called Project Vista, when U.S. nuclear assets were very scarce, recommended allocating nukes to NATO to stop the Soviet army rather than focusing on city busting, big hydrogen bombs to blow up Soviet cities, because he thought you could beat the Soviets much better by defeating its army than you could by blowing up cities. I think that still holds true for today. I think, well, anyway, we can get into that debate. But just to say that nuclear weapons were introduced into Europe for two main purposes. Number one, to stop the Soviet army in what seemed like an inevitable invasion. And number two, nuclear sharing arrangements were developed because the U.S. Army could not be everywhere. So, for instance, for nuclear artillery, you either had to have U.S. nuclear artillery units attached to every single unit up and down the West German border. And as you know, there was the Dutch sector, there was the Belgian sector, there was the French sector, UK sector, Canadian sector. Or you would give them the capability under wartime conditions to launch those nuclear weapons. So that was one reason. The other reason is because you want the NATO allies to actually be involved. You want them to have a say, to have their fingers on the trigger, to be part of the whole nuclear deterrent. Otherwise, it's war happens in Europe, ? Victory. No, the allies have to be part of every stage of planning and thinking about the alliance. And this is why, from the introduction of nuclear weapons into Europe in 1954 up until 62, who was the Canadian foreign minister and then Prime Minister Pearson, who started the Three Wise Men to try to improve the political planning and coordination at NATO headquarters. Then the Harmel report really solidifies it. But it's all about how to get the European allies not to be infantile and saying, the Americans will help us, but to say, no, we have a say at everything. And the Nuclear Planning Group established in December 1966 to force the allies to really think about where are we going to use nuclear weapons, when these are going to affect all of your troops. And so the idea of nuclear sharing is, number one, the defense of Europe. Number two, the idea that all allies are part of the defense of Europe. And number three, that we have this communication, this sharing of information that would not happen otherwise, of planning. Because even now, with far fewer nuclear weapons in the alliance, if you were to remove nuclear sharing from the alliance, I can guarantee you that within a couple of years, the debate, the NPG will go away, the nuclear planning group, the high-level group of the nuclear planning group will go away. The U.S. will talk less and less to the allies about what their nuclear plans are. The allies will feel completely divorced from this nuclear planning, and it'll be something that the U.S. does rather than something that the NATO alliance does. That's why I always tell my American colleagues who are like, well, maybe we can reduce USDCA in Europe. It's like, no. Europeans have to be part of this. They have to have a say. They have to touch metal. They have to have the moral and military and political responsibility for the defense of their territory. And that means being part of nuclear sharing. We all are part of this together. It is core to the alliance. I think it was a great innovation in 54. I think the nuclear planning group in 66 was essential. The high level group in 77. All these steps have been amazing. And to take that away, again, is to infantilize Europe and to make the defense of Europe seem like an abstract concept that's handled by other people. And that can't be the way the future is.
Right. In many ways, William, this is the political level corollary of what we were talking about before in terms of public debate. You're on the hook for this. You're involved in this. This concerns you. Therefore, you should know about it and you should care about it from tip to tail. So you've got to actually be part of that. And Aaron, that gets us back to the question of the nuclear taboo, doesn't it?
Yeah, it certainly does. And I would say that it does because, I mean, if you have this buy-in, as you were talking about, William, about into the nuclear arrangements that defend your own territory, that actually, I would argue, helps to reinforce the nuclear taboo a bit, maybe at least for yourself. But the nuclear taboo has come in several times during this episode. So I'd like to ask a question about it. You won't have to look very far, I should say, to find a Ukrainian who would argue that they should never have given up their nuclear weapons. Of course, they're referring to the Budapest Memorandum, where they did just that after the fall of the USSR in exchange for guarantees on their territorial integrity, guarantees that Putin obviously violated. But what I sometimes am alarmed by is that I hear people in other capitals, including in NATO member capitals, who say nuclear weapons are starting to look pretty good right now. So is the war in Ukraine changing up the incentives for countries to get their own weapons? And if so, where does that leave us?
I did leave out one other reason why the US does nuclear sharing, and it's actually to prevent our allies from developing their own nuclear weapons. In 1960, President Kennedy made the famous speech saying, "I don't want to leave a world where we have 25 nuclear powers." And the fact that U.S. efforts, not only through nuclear sharing, but also designing, drafting, and negotiating the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which entered into force in 1970, have been amazing at limiting the number of nuclear weapon states on Earth. And that's very important. So, yes, I think the Ukraine conflict has the potential to teach a lot of countries very interesting lessons on nuclear weapons use. Now, the counterfactual of going back to 1994 and Ukraine keeping its nuclear weapons is nonsense. Ukraine would be a pariah state in the center of Europe. They would look like North Korea. They would be shunned by everyone. They would be in a far worse position than they are right now. They had to get rid of those things. Those were Soviet weapons, the 12th GUMO, the 12th GUMO declared itself for Russia. That was an important part of getting nuclear weapons out of Belarus and Ukraine and Kazakhstan. Nuclear weapons were also on the territory of Hungary and Poland and East Germany. They were in the Baltics. I mean, we had to get those out and back to Russian territory. Okay. But leaving that aside, you make the point, do you need nuclear weapons to defend yourself? Well, I think North Vietnam would say, do you? Really? Okay. South Korea, do they need nuclear weapons? So far, the answer is no. They made a run at it once. The U.S. stopped them. But what a lot of these things show me is that the idea that you would have nuclear weapons and you'd be immune from attack or pressure, ask Israel how that's going. There are many times in the world where smaller states are incentivized to attack larger states, and it happens. And the presence or absence of nuclear weapons is not germane to that debate. And the idea that nuclear weapons are, for instance, going to transform Iran's security is nonsense. It's not going to help them. They're still going to be under attack by hybrid warfare from Israel, top to bottom. Enemies will still come after them below the level of out and out direct invasion. So we have to dispel some of those illusions. But at the same time, the best way to prevent proliferation after this war is to make sure that Russia not only loses, but is seen to lose. Because the way that they have wielded threats throughout this conflict, if they are seen to profit from that, that might send a really dangerous message. And the United States is going to have to work really hard to then try to reverse that. Really, the quickest and easiest path to show that Ukraine doesn't need nuclear weapons is to defeat Russia.
By trying to manage escalation, you invite it. Carrie.
Yeah, but as I said before, how we seek to dominate the information space is really, we, the West, is really important. If the West self-deters in its support for Ukraine in response to nuclear saber rattling by Putin, we send the signal that nuclear blackmail works, not a good signal. If there's Russian use with a very limited Western response, it would send a message that nuclear use works, which is even worse message. So we have to help Ukraine win. But we also have to carefully calibrate our messaging about a response to use and our overall support for Ukraine And I think it should be more robust, our messaging, and a little more visible, transparent, and a lot more with our own citizens to bring them along with the governments in the world.
Kerry, given all that's been said there, what is NATO to do?
I think that there's more room to further isolate and dissuade, as I said, pretty robust messages about the consequences being catastrophic if Russia uses a nuclear weapon. And include in that not just public messaging, but also that private diplomacy with China and India, and continue with that because it's not a given. You'll need constant and sustained diplomacy, including beyond China and India, but also to ensure that the rest of the world comes along with the West to the extent possible. Two, there's considerable room for shock and awe sanctions still. Get them ready and communicate that to Russia as well, including some of the Russian oligarchs who will pay big. Three, watch inside Russia very closely and prepare. Watch what they're doing more than what Putin is saying, especially around nuclear storage sites. We've got better eyes on than we had in 2014. Watch their military exercises closely to see if their radiological defense forces are, for instance, interacting with other forces. And support those in the region with radiological nuclear defense equipment, but also hardening our own defenses against CBRN, including DCA bases, airports, seaports. But here's the big one. I think part of the calculus from Russia is the slowness of NATO and Western decision-making. And so there are processes and technologies that we can do inside NATO, the North Atlantic Council, to speed up NATO decision-making. Some of it's digital, cloud computing, low Earth orbit satellites, but also analog, more intel sharing. So we take away that advantage of Russia relying on the slower decision-making of democracies. And then, as I said earlier, just understand that broader strategic perspective about the impact of the West's response to Putin's threats on the incentive or disincentive for the rest of the world to acquire nuclear weapons. It's a bigger game that's being played. It's well beyond Ukraine.
Absolutely. And while the road to victory and the road to credible deterrence runs through Ukraine, it is a road that goes beyond as well. We need to stop letting Russia dictate the terms here. And in addition to the practical steps that Kerry very well outlined just then, we discussed briefly earlier this catastrophic response, this devastating response that the US could potentially unleash. You often hear skepticism about that expressed around some of the circles that you and I both move in. Perhaps you could just outline what that might look like, what would be devastating and catastrophic, and with which capabilities the US would actually be able to do that.
I mean, if it came down to wanting to punish Russia for a nuclear use in Ukraine, I would advise the president to absolutely flatten Russian radars and air defenses, everything from their artillery support and counter battery radars up to, you know, the bigger air defense radars, all their air defense sites, everything in occupied Ukraine, and that includes Crimea. Sink the Black Sea Fleet if it's in Ukrainian territory. So if they have any submarines in port in Crimea, blow them up. And basically provide the degradation of Russian assets in Ukraine that allows Ukraine significant regional advantages in certain areas. So, you know, the destruction of ammunition depots, local command control structures, etc. In other words, just one of those blows that basically paves the way for larger Ukrainian victories. And if you make that clear that that's what you're going to do, and that if Russia escalates further, then Russian territory itself is in play, and that you as the United States and the NATO alliance aren't going to take any response off the table. So yes, your initial response is going to be conventional, but you don't say nuclear is not on the table. You say everything's on the table, but you know, our initial response is going to be devastating, conventional, and proportionate to what you did. It's going to be about making you lose in Ukraine. So we're not going to strike Belgorod, but we are going to make sure that every single Russian soldier in Ukraine cannot rely upon air support, artillery support, command and control, ammunition, etc. So you're talking about JASMs, you know, standoff air-launched cruise missiles from U.S. platforms, this is the kind of thing that the U.S. Plans on, you know, the sort of the mass first strike that wipes things out. And if everything is flying at Ukraine, you can manage the escalation there. You know, don't fire it from, for instance, over the North Pole across Russian territory. That would be escalatory. But firing it instead from firing points where the majority of all the missile tracks are going over NATO and Ukrainian territory. I think that's all you'd have to do. And quite frankly, even the threat of that, even, you know, moving up the capabilities to do that would send a massive deterrence message. So as Kerry was saying, if you saw the early political warnings, the military warning signs, if you saw the 12th Gumo moving out from Sergei Posad, if you saw, you know, nuclear weapons being moved via train or emergency air transport, if you saw the kinds of, you know, Seaburny defense they'd have to put in place, that you would, first of all, make the direct communication signal that we will impose costs that will absolutely defeat the very purpose of what you're doing and ensure Ukrainian victory. And number two, you know, any further use will not be limited to Ukrainian territory and may not be limited to any individual combat domain. That sends the right deterrence message. And then it's back up to Putin. If he feels like calling that bluff, okay. I don't think he will. I think ultimately we may not agree with Putin's calculations, but I do believe he is a rational player within his own value system. And the thing that he wants the most is continued power and continued strength. And if he is not only loses, but is seen to lose against a massive strike because of his miscalculation, that would threaten his power. Whereas, you know, he can, on his own terms, declare some kind of weird victory here and say this was what he meant all along, you know. So I think, you know, a massive, what do the South Koreans call it? Deterrence by massive punishment at the conventional level is exactly what I think would make Russia back down once you see the signs and signals that Kerry was talking about.
Thank you, William. And thank you, Kerry, for outlining to us why we need to get our military, our nuclear and non-nuclear elements of our military deterrence, right? And we need to get it aligned with our political thinking and the way that we had our organizations actually working and together how we actually communicate between ourselves, but also with our publics to make sure that's a coherent message that sends a signal of strength backed up by the credible capabilities to deliver that means that we probably won't have to fight and face that threat. And thinking through all of this beyond panic and beyond just the horror of the potential consequences of what could be visited upon us is an essential part of that. And we hope to be part of that conversation now through this episode and going forward.
That's all for this episode of Berlin Side Out. Thank you very much to our guests today, Kerry Buck, Fabian Hoffman, and William L. Burke. Thank you also to our project assistant, Julen Stuckle, our technical producer, Hendrik Werner, and the DJP team, as well as a special thanks to WISE Canada Chair, Aaron Koenig. Join us as we start wrapping up season two with our discussion on the pillars of Ukrainian victory and how to achieve them. For now, though, from Berlin, auf Wiedersehen and tschüss.